This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
All right, so I am back, and this is, my name is Conda Mason, and I am happy to be here on this podcast, and it's called The Brown Rice Hour, having conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. And my guest today is Jakata Imani, who is a dear friend and comrade here in the Bay Area. And I'm really happy that you're joining me, Jakata. Thank you for saying yes. Yes.
Of course. Always yes. That's just about anything you ask me to do. That I ever said no.
Likewise. So I'd like to get started first with just like opening up a little bit of sacred space, if we can do that. And in that, I just want to take a moment to honor, you know, those who came before us, our ancestors who have, if it weren't for them, we would not be here, all that they have survived, all that they had to survive to get us here. And they sit on my shoulders on either side of me all the time, and I am fully aware of them, and I just want to give honor to all of our ancestors who have gone through great lengths for us to do the work that we do, and infuse us with their energy and with their passion and with their love. And then I also want to just give thanks for the work that we do, honoring the work that you do, Jay, the work that is being done at this time on the planet to make the kind of transformations that need to be made. And I want to also honor those who are coming behind us, who may we leave a better place, a better planet for them. And may we be there as their ancestors, cheering them on. And so with that, I just want to give thanks for all beings everywhere.
Ashe.
Ashe, ashe. So that just allows us to have a little bit of energy around this conversation. I want to introduce you. You are such an icon in the Bay Area for sure, and throughout the country, and the work that you've been just leading. And it's some of the most important work that needs to be done, as you've spent so much time with our youth and allowing them, giving them that kind of liberation and freedom that they need to be who they are, and getting obstacles out of the way. And so I'm going to read your bio here, that Chikata Imani is a spiritually rooted coach and trainer with 30 years experience working for racial, social, and economic justice. He's the chair of the board of One Life Institute, which serves at the intersection of spirituality and social action. And over the last three decades, Chikata has worked for organizations and or supported movements working on campaigning to close youth prisons, fight for workers' rights, tenant organizing, and green jobs. In 2013, he received a Changemaker Fellowship from Pacific School of Religion, where he served for 2 years leading the Ignite Institute. It's a center for spiritual and social transformation. Currently, Reverend Chikata serves as the board president of Greenpeace USA. So with that, I want to welcome you and all that you bring to this podcast here. I just, you know, your work is just outstanding. And it's been held by so many people. And there's this theme that I want to get into around, I see this theme around spirituality and social justice. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But before that, I have a question for you. That's the pop question. So my question is, this is something that I kind of, so I named this Brown Rice Hour because one thing is I love brown rice, and it was instrumental in changing my life. I became a macrobiotic back in the day, and it was a big change for me, right? And it was kind of this pivotal moment. And now that I'm in Louisiana, literally growing rice, it's one of those things that, and I'm a foodie, okay? So, what I want to ask you is, what was the comfort food that you had as a child, and who prepared it? And you're on.
So, food was such a big thing in my house. My grandmother is from Raleigh, North Carolina, actually right outside of Raleigh, up in the hills above the city. And food was such a thing. And I think my mother prepared like everything. I used to refer to her as the Black Betty Crocker, because she could whip up anything in terms of food and especially desserts. But the thing, and I think I'm passing this on to my youngest daughter, is grits and eggs was just such a butter, cheesy grits with a fried egg and if we were lucky, a biscuit. So, right, like that was the thing that is such a thing for me growing up. And then I went to New Orleans and I saw shrimp and grits. So now me and my youngest daughter, that's our Sunday morning ritual. We get up on Sunday morning and make some shrimp and grits with some spinach and some shrimp and do the thing. But so growing up for me, it was just that simple thing of like some hot grits, buttery, some garlic powder in there, black pepper, and it was Sunday morning. So yeah, that was my mother made that.
That was it. And your mom made it. That's really great. Yeah. Great. It's funny because you're only the second person I've interviewed on this podcast so far. And the other one was Fania Davis. And when I asked her the question, she said, grits.
Oh, okay. So we just going to keep it real stereotypical Black people.
I know, right? But it was her dad who made it. It was interesting. It was her dad had to, he was the cook in the morning when they were getting ready for breakfast for school. So yeah, I can tell. And I asked her, I wanted to make sure it wasn't sweet grits, because people who add the sugar to grits, no, right? Exactly. Grits and cheese and grits.
I try to keep an open mind. You know what I mean? I try not to have a binary. I try to make space for all views and opinions. But sweet grits,
Why? Right? It's like, when I even heard about sweet grits, I was like, no. No. Yeah, but I
don't know.
Yeah, no. You have an open mind. I don't quite have the open mind that you have. I'm like, I'm very judgmental.
I mean, I want to, but I still have to give it the side eye every time somebody grabs the sugar and go for it. Like, this is not oatmeal. You realize this is not oatmeal.
Right. This is not oatmeal. This is grits.
No.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, I'm so glad you. Oh. Okay, so we even closer than we were before this podcast. Same with Vanya. She was like, "Oh no sweet grits."
We can do. I might do some research on the internet and ask my friends, like, and see where their people came from. Who threw sugar in it? Maybe there's like a. Oh. I don't know, but I don't know.
Maybe it's geography. I think that would be really interesting to put on Facebook, like grits, sweet or not sweet? Sweet, sugar or butter?
Sweet or savory?
Sweet or
savory. And where are you from?
And where are you from? Okay, we're going to do that.
And where your people from? Where your grandmama from? Where your granddaddy from? I need to know. We're going to get the map. Because I want to understand. Maybe there were some people, you know, I don't, maybe it's a Caribbean thing. I don't know. I don't mean to insult the Caribbeans if you're not with sweet grits. But maybe it's something. We just, you know, I just missed it.
I love it. Both of that. Everybody's grits. Well, I am not at all surprised, my brother, because of who you are and the fortitude that you have. I think that the grits have something to do with that. I do indeed. And so I just want to go back to what I said, moving into this question of spirituality and social justice. So, you know, the One Life Institute, which I love, and the work that you have done. But before we go there, I want to know where it all started. Like, where did your passion around social justice begin? Like, was there an incident in your life that got you there? Was it your family? What? I'm really curious of that because it's more than a choice. Is you driven? This is something that just feels like it's way deeper than a choice. Like you didn't have no choice.
Yeah, I didn't have a choice. No. So I mean, there's so many things. So part of it, you know, I'm from Oakland and I'm second generation. My mother was born and raised here. I was born and raised here. My mother grew up with the young folks who were in the Panthers. And those were like, she just was like, those are nappy headed boys who are trying to pop the girls made out of jackets, trying to be cute. But that's sort of like, but the osmosis of like that moment of Black politics and growing up in and around that, as well as the music and the culture and funk and that it was just in the, so some of it was in the water. And so, and then some of it was also, you know, I came awake, like realizing things was going on when Ronald Reagan became president. That's when I like really was like starting to not just look at my like the four walls of my home and the four walls of my school and then my, you know, my extended family and crew, but I started seeing like there are larger things happening at play, right? Yeah. And I grew up in East Oakland in fourth grade, third grade, they discovered I had dyslexia. And my mother heard that the schools in the hills in Oakland that are in the more affluent white neighborhoods had better special education programs, which wasn't true. It was the same Black and brown boys in special ed up there as it was in the filing. But nonetheless, that's what she heard. And so that put me, though, in a school that wasn't just other Black and brown kids, but had like a percentage in elementary school, a high percentage of upper middle class white folks, but then also upper middle class Black and brown folks and Asian folks. Mm-hmm. And I got to be friends with some of those people and got to see that there were like, you know, I went to this one girl's house in seventh grade and her family had an elevator that they lived in Oakland Hills. In their house, they had an elevator that, you know, it's one of them houses. You've been to the Oakland Hills. You drive up to the top and you get it. You walk in through the front door. They're in the garage or in the top floor. And you have to take an elevator down to like where the kitchen and the bathroom and stuff are. And then an elevator down to, or you can take the stairs, but they had an elevator. And I was just like, whoa, right? And I got to know people. I started seeing like, oh, there's actually some of the same stuff happening up here that folks are using drugs and folks are dealing drugs and folks are having domestic disputes. And there's folks who are having conflict in their family, but there weren't the police coming. They weren't losing their housing. They weren't.
Same issue.
And what I saw was very similar issues, very similar. But like my friend's older sister who was having drug problems, she didn't get arrested. She got sent to her, you know, her family house in Vermont or whatever, you know, or she got to go to residential treatment and other folks who, you know, they got picked up and taken home as opposed to taken to jail. Right. For doing very similar things. And so it was that experience. And, once I was in, there's this district in Oakland called Montclair, which is, it's actually called Montclair Village. And it's a very little set apart, little, very affluent neighborhood in Oakland. And I was there on a weekend with some of my other friends, me being the darkest of them. And we were all goofing around and they crossed the street and I was talking to somebody and I crossed the street late and I sort of jaywalked. This black cop pulls me up and he's like,
"We not have
bet that. Not, bet not. Bet not see you out here like this no more." And the contradiction that was wild about it was he singled me out, but he thought he was doing me a favor.
Right. Teaching you.
Right.
Don't do this up in here.
Mm-hmm. You got to know where your place is.
Right.
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 And I'm going to show you where your place is.
Like, don't
because
drink water fountain. It's the equivalent of don't drink water fountain unless colored is written on it.
Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so for me at a young age, I got to see that there were systems and structures that like, that were not set up to talk about what I knew was true. And so I would go home and talk about like, oh, we read this, we did the Pledge of Allegiance. And my parents would talk to me about the Pledge of Allegiance. And like, you know, my dad was in the army and he was like, yo, the way I got treated in the army, we're not one nation. They treated me very differently, even though I'm fighting for our country. And then I had uncles who were talking to me about, and aunties who I got to just see, like, and they would share with me just the little pieces of just asking the questions. And so that was my first entree into like, things aren't the same. People get treated differently based on the color of their skin or based on the amount of money in their bank. And I grew up during the height of the drug war. And so it wasn't just that there weren't police up when I went to Montclair, you know, there weren't police on every single corner, but there were in my neighborhood, in every single corner, even though the same amount of crime was happening in those neighborhoods, there was no police to disrupt it or no police to solve those problems. What solved those problems were the community working together and services and treatment. In my neighborhood, there was no opportunity for that. It was just, you're out of line, let's go. We got you. You might be on the line. You're standing on the corner. We're sweeping you up, right? At a high rate. And so that gave me a sense, this ain't right, which got me curious.
Right, right, right. And how old were you at that point in time, ish?
13, 12, 13 years old.
A young boy. Interesting.
Yeah.
And so that's where you started seeing the discrepancies.
And wanting to speak out and wanting to just pose the questions, talk about it, understand it.
And so it stayed with you, those questions, the questions of, and your need to speak out just stayed with you. You, that was the only way to satisfy it, was to do the work that you're doing.
Well, I mean, I think that the need to speak out was the, like, I think initially my thing was like, oh, people don't notice or they don't know. Mm-hmm. Right. And if I say something about it, then they will, like, it's like, if you step on my foot and you didn't step on my foot and you didn't know you stepped on my foot. Well, okay. Well, you stepped on my foot. I'm gonna let you know. Hey, that's my foot. Right.
Right.
But what I found out is when I would say something about it, like just pointing it out, like, oh, you're stepping on my foot. People would be like, sit down and shut up. And I'm like, but wait, though. You're stepping on my foot. And they're like, yes, I am. And sit down and shut up. Like, move on, right? And then I started feeling like, well, wait, why would you want to be just stepping on my foot every time you walk past me? Like, what is this about? Like, why are you, right? And so then it didn't start as like this thing where it was just like, oh, I just simply thought, like, if I pointed out there's a discrepancy here, right? Like, so in class, when I was in high school, in science class, we had a test and we were doing biology. We had a test on the anatomy of frogs. A week later, we got the test back. Teacher said, we don't have enough frogs for everybody. So people who do not do well on the test won't get a frog to dissect. Only people who did well will get dissect the frogs. Limited resources, we're going to figure out how we're going to disperse them. Well, what I noticed was it was the Black and Latin kids who did not do well on the test. It was the white and Asian kids who did do well on the written test. When I also thought, I don't know, 18, 17, I don't know why, but I just thought intuitively that, well, maybe if we didn't do well on the written part, we could learn better with our hands. Mm-hmm. And so that if you gave us a frog that we got to dissect it, that we would then learn we didn't learn on the paper and from reading it, right? And then the people who did well on the written part, they don't need to dissect the frog because they understand it.
Right, they don't need the frog. Right.
And if you don't let any of us who didn't do well on the test, then there will not be one Black or Latin kid who gets to dissect the frog. And I'm just going to raise this for you. I'm just going to raise this as, like, this might be discriminatory and it might not be the best pedagogy. I raised that up in high school. The teacher calmly walked over to the phone and said, security, I have a student disrupting my classroom.
Oh, my God. Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Wow.
Because he was confronted, this teacher, with his racist practice. And as opposed to being able to engage in it.
Right.
He was just like, you got to leave.
Yeah. 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 That was like an Amy Cooper call.
Right. Right. But I didn't know. There wasn't no video cameras then. I couldn't just put him on video and be like, y'all, this is what I'm dealing with. Say it again. You know what I mean? So then I realized... after like years and years of being in the movement and having incredible mentors, that's the other thing about being in the Bay Area is you get to meet people like you. Mm-hmm. You get to meet people like Fania. You get to meet people like Angela Davis. You get to meet, you know, Phil Hutchings. You get to meet all these amazing, amazing people, right? Who've been in a struggle and can give you game. And so I got to learn from people and read amazing things and talk to folks who are in the struggle about like, what they've been doing, how they did it.
Yeah.
Not just inspiration, but I got to get information about the strategies and the organizational structures. And, I grew up in the Bay Area where there was a free breakfast program that the Panthers ran way before the United States government ever thought about free breakfast. Yeah. So I got to sit with people who engineered that and ask them questions about, where did you get the food?
I've always wondered that.
Yeah.
Where did
the food? Well, so they went... Here's what I heard from people. They went to store owners in the neighborhood and they said, you make money from our people. You're going to give back to our people.
Give back.
We need this amount of food every week at these locations. If we don't have that, we will be back here to have this conversation again outside with a picket line.
Mm-hmm.
And then store owners were like, yo, these brothers with black leather jackets and these sisters with these shotguns, we just gonna give them this food because they go. They right, black people come in here and buy all our stuff, so we should feed black children, and they fed black children.
Wow, interesting. I always wondered where that food came from. That's wonderful to hear that. You know, and I was going to ask you also. I have a question to ask you: who were your mentors? And so you kind of, are there anyone out of the group specific? I mean, anyone rises to the top more than others? Who are your mentors? And you know. Getting you the knowledge and where you are.
Yeah, you know, so I would be like totally remiss if I didn't mention Van Jones, Rachel Jackson, Steve Williams, Cindy Wisner. There was a cohort of folks who were ahead of me in the Bay Area. Kay Vacanti now, who is at runs Red Bay Coffee and is like an amazing and has been an amazing entrepreneur, but is like, you know what I mean? Remaking the coffee game. All these folks, just like as a young activist, both sometimes in like real intimate ways and other times just watching them do what they do, right? Like, and being able to sit in the room with them and watch them get down. And then later in life, Cherie Tang, who's one of my mentors, and I still call Cherie when I run into stuff, but I'm like, I don't know what to do. And this, I call Cherie and she'll just drop jewels on me, right? Nice. Yeah. And then, you know, the founder of One License Two, Liza Rankow, has been like taught me how to bring it together with, you know, because growing up Black in the Bay, there was this sort of like funk and hip hop hustler culture and this Black Panther radical Black organizing, multiracial organizing,
right,
and this deep spiritual tradition, right, that I didn't fully understand until I hooked up with Liza and Reverend Liza, and she was able to like show me like, oh no, Howard Thurman been circling the building. You just didn't know who he was, you know?
Yeah.
And she put me on to Howard Thurman. I was like, oh, I've been feeling this energy the whole time.
Howard Thurman. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So this gets us to the conversation about spirituality and social justice.
Right.
And so, well, first, were you raised religious or what was that at all in your home?
So my parents were spiritual, but not religious. When I was born, right? So they would, every summer, at the start of summer, they would send me off to vacation Bible school, one of my aunties or some of my cousins, the day church, you know? Mm-hmm. So I did that like twice, three times. But they themselves didn't really go to church as like a thing. Like they didn't. My mother later in life went started going to church. But there was this spiritual thing in our family that wasn't actually religious.
Okay.
And I came to spirituality actually through hip hop organizing. It was through the Universal Zulu Nation and the work of Afrika Bambaataa that had a serious spiritual connection there. In the Bay Area chapter of Zulu Nation, we had people who were practicing African spiritual traditions, Ifa and Yoruba, Sateria. We have folks who are practicing Muslims. We have folks who are doing Christian liberation theology, and folks who are super, you know, sort of doing pagan indigenous spirituality. All coming together around hip hop and bringing together that positive energy. And we would begin and end every one of our cycles with a prayer. So that's where I really learned to pray in a group, was with Zulu Nation in the Bay.
That is.
And I went on this own journey for myself, just trying to understand when I was younger, asking people like, is there a God? What is God? How does God work? And Christianity, because I was like so steeped in African and Black revolutionary traditions and understanding the sort of the role of the church and Christianity as disrupting Black freedom struggle at a global level, right? Like enslaving us, siding with slavers, right? All this stuff, right? That I was like, I can't see you, right? And then there was also so many people using it at the time I was growing up, that the church was not aligned with the movement broadly, right? It was aligned with the state in all of this sort of like quote unquote anti-drugs and crime reduction, violence prevention, BS, where they were likely to call the cops on us than whether I'd come out and talk with us, right?
And you were also born after,
and so
right. I mean, this is all post King.
Oh yeah.
So that's because
this is post King,
a big part of the movement. Then post King.
Yeah, and even in my research, there was like, you know, 20% of the Black church. And if you know, I've got to rap with some of the OGs who were in you know, like Phil Hutchins was the last General Secretary of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And I got to talk with some of those folks about the work and some of the folks who went on the Freedom Ride. And they were like, yeah, all these people out here telling you they marched with Dr. King, half of these fools is lying. Because that if everybody would have marched, that we would have had like 12, 15 million people in the street. So don't give me that, right? So there was like a portion, and for good and bad reasons, but there was a portion of the Black church that was really aligned. And there were a lot of folks because their building was owned by a white person that they worked for down at the Ford plant and didn't want to lose their job. Those churches were not aligned. They were silent on those questions organizationally.
Right.
And so by the time we came along, you know, the right in this country and white supremacy had divided Black youth in particular, who were seen as troublemakers or at risk or dangerous, from the church in the main, especially working class folks on the streets.
Yeah.
Right. Like I remember when I first started at Baker Center, door knocking in North Oakland at a church, talking about an incident of police brutality that happened. So this young man sat on the corner the other day and got beat up and want to talk to you about it. And the first thing the pastor said to me was, what was he doing on the corner?
Right.
And I was like, wait. I told you the cops whipped this boy and I want to talk. And you say, why was he
standing there?
Right. Yeah. Right. And then like 6 months later, the police whipped on one of the people who went to the church, who was standing outside on the corner after church, him and some of his friends, and they whipped on this boy. So the pastor called me, and you know, and I was like, didn't say what I wanted to say, which was, what were you doing on the corner? Right. I just said, okay, I'm glad you called, Pastor.
Right.
Right.
You called. Okay. Okay. So that's a little mixed bag. And then, but when you took it upon yourself to align yourself with Christianity, and I would say yes, and well, okay,
to go see about it. Yeah, go see. I wouldn't go see about it.
Got it. Okay. Well, why don't you just describe what happened?
I came to talk to you about this in one of the conversations we had, and you were one of the people, but I understood, and this is one of the beautiful things about growing up here with some of my OGs, when we would go, like, I was a part of an organization called Todos, which means all of us in Spanish, that did youth organizing around anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobic, unlearning those practices, working with young people. And they taught us some of the freedom songs at those camps. Mm. That folks were singing because they got handed down those. So, welcome my mind on freedom. Gonna lay down my sword and shield. Yeah. Well, all these freedom songs, and I realized I knew these songs, and that from Zulu, Universal Zulu Nation, these streams started to merge, where my sense of that I understood that there was this divine realm. And I understood that there was this worldly political realm, and that I was acting as if those two things were not connected. Uh-huh. Right. And I didn't know how to connect those things because I didn't grow up in the Black church and in a deeply liberatory or transformational theology, that the pop theology around me was so like prosperity gospels, if you believe it, you can achieve it. And I'm like, well, my people been believing this shit for a long ass time, and we still dying and ain't got no money. Right. So I couldn't get in. But so I was questioning this path. And then I went and talked to you and other folks about like Angel Kyoto Williams, I went and sat with, like, yo, how you doing this? I know you better. Angel is like, you are amazing. How is you dealing with this spiritual stuff? That's like, you know, you're a Zen Buddhist priest. How are you dealing with this? Help me understand, right? And it was like you, it was Angel, Reverend Liza, Reverend Dorothy Blake, Dr. Reverend Blake, put me on to like, okay, there is a path here that's obscured, and that you can understand some of this path. It's like, you know, you don't have to talk about slave master religion. You can talk about the resistance religion of the enslaved. And so that hop over to Thurman got me to PSR, Pacific School of Religion, where they had a fellowship to study spirituality and social justice. And it's a multi-denominational progressive Christian seminary. Mm-hmm. And I went to try to go see and try to understand, okay, what have the tradition of Black folks found? My friends, people I come from, what did they find mm-hmm. in this? And that's what led me down that path where I got to see, like, okay, that when folks were in the fields during enslavement, the whole story was about Moses. This was not about Jesus. It was Christianity, but it was a different form of Christianity. It was a form of Christianity that was about liberation and that, and enslavement and being captive in that Exodus journey. That's what we were about. And all the songs and all the traditions and even the way people worshiped. And that there's been something that's happened over the last 50 to 100 years that's moved us more towards this sort of a more Christology, Christian focused. Yeah. And I say we Black people, that is less about the here and now, less about how do we transform, how do we treat each other. But it was Howard Thurman who gave me access to that tradition directly. And for people who don't know Thurman among your listeners, he was the man who went to India and met Gandhi and brought back nonviolence direct action to the civil rights movement here. He was a mentor of the Reverend Dr. King. And so when King says, I can't ever be who I ought to be until you get to be who you ought to be, that's directly from Thurman, right? And he led the first integrated church in the United States, which was over in San Francisco and still is there virtually every Sunday, led by Reverend Dr. Dorsey Blake. It's called the Fellowship for the Church of All Peoples, and it was the first integrated church. And Thurman helped me understood how his book, Jesus of the Disinherited, which is like understanding Jesus as a subjugated, not as the king on a throne, which is somehow people talk about it, but as a subjugated person in an occupied Roman territory, an indigenous working class person talking to other indigenous working class people mm-hmm. about how they're going to get free through and how they and what their values and morals are mm-hmm. in that context. Which just unlocked the whole, blew my mind.
Yeah, that's a whole another orientation. That's a whole other orientation around Jesus. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I mean, yeah, you can see that. That made sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that opened it up for me to like, as the Reverend Thurman would say, embrace aspects of the tradition that's named after Jesus without becoming a Christian, because, you know, it's complicated. But my basic summation is after doing a deep reading of Jesus and even what's in the Bible, is he was not trying to create a new religion. I ain't trying to offend nobody. We don't have to get into the theology, but he was talking to Jewish people about how they could be Jewish.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's what they say about they say the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist.
Right. And so, which is not to say that I can't learn from his mm-hmm. his teachings, that I can't learn from those folks what they've done, but it's to say that then I have to figure out my own path and my own in community. And that's the thing that I got to, the blessing for me at PSR was understanding the three things about faith communities that I think our movements need and we're beginning to form, which are that we have a clear moral center that is not wavering. We have a clear moral, ethical framework. And for us right now, this notion of Black Lives Matter, this and all the things that comes with that, like for Black lives to fully matter in our global context, right, in the United States and beyond, there's a ton of implications that if we really hold that as true, if we take that as we say the good word gospel, Black Lives Matter, that opens up all kinds of different discussions about what that looks like in full autonomy for every Black person. That means like Black, queer, trans, gender nonconforming, people differently abled. No. We don't get to say, well, then you're not like the rest of us. So just a little bit of that. No. All those, right? And then Black people, it turns out, come in every hue. So then like you got to get real thoughtful about what you mean. And our families contain every hue. So I can't be like, oh, Conda, I care about you, but oh, you married to an indigenous, oh, you married to a, or you love a, or you're a child. Well, right? It just, it's this real deep.
That's right.
No. It's invitational. That's right. And deeply radically invitational at the center. Radical. And then there is an individual.
That radical longing.
Yes, radical. That makes me a little uncomfortable as I start to like learn it and figure it out and figure out like, ooh, I don't know how to talk about this thing. I don't know.
Right.
Ooh, I just assumed your pronouns. I'm like, ooh, or you told me your pronouns and then I messed it up because of my old thinking. Now I got to sit with that for a minute, right? So that radical inclusion. And then there is the other thing that faith communities have is they have individual practice to bring us back to that ethical grounding. And so that may be meditation or prayer.
Practice, practice, practice. How important it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they have that. But then the other thing they have is communal practice, right? Mm-hmm. That just you meditating or just you doing yoga or just you praying, that ain't going to get it. That ain't going to get it. We're going to have to do it together,
right?
So all three of those things.
That's right. Collectively.
We can co-create, a new world. Mm-hmm. And so that was the thing I came out of within... my studies at PSR, my studies of Christian and other faiths. And that's the thing we have to have. And that's the thing that often makes me weary of the unorganized, unaffiliated, just learn how to do this thing. Let's come and just be mindful. And I'm like, you can be mindful about destroying the world.
Yes, you can.
You can be very present to...
Mm-hmm. That's right. You can be very mindful in that lab and taking away human life. Or you can be very, very mindful. And that's not it either. Exactly. Exactly.
Because so we need the ethical grounding.
Where are the ethics around it, right? Where it has to be based in this ethical frame that you talked about from the very beginning. And that is something that, I feel is... it's at the core of where I'm hoping that every movement that we are a part of right now, mm-hmm. is what is the ethical framework that it is sitting in, right? I'm curious what you think about, so here we are, I don't know, 3 weeks after the death of George Floyd, mm-hmm. and the whole world has responded in so many ways. And it's really quite something what I think we're seeing right now. The streets, the young
people, it is.
Streets of America and all over the world. I'm curious what you think about this movement right now and what is it that, is it any part excites you? Is any part of it make you want to say, okay, and?
I found it profoundly exciting. I mean,
are you hopeful?
That I was talking with a friend of mine, Saket Soni, who is he runs an amazing this organization called Resilience Force, and he comes out of he lived in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, and he has been now to like almost every major disaster area in certainly the United States and quite possibly northern hemisphere. And we were talking about, this is when COVID at first happened. We were talking about, I was asking him to talk about this to some other groups, some folks we were working with, to talk about, and I said, I don't want to call it an opportunity because that feels so crass. But I know that you've been in this space before, Saket. Can you talk about it? And he said, yeah, no, we can't talk about it as an opportunity. This is just devastation that's happening to people.
Say that one more time.
When the COVID virus and the pandemic first started to take root, we were talking to some other folks we were organizing with, and I wanted Saket to talk with us about what his experience had been going to disaster areas, which is not exactly corollary, but the only thing I could grasp for that was like, what is it like to be when everything falls apart?
Right.
What happens? And what there's something when there's a breakdown, there's the opportunity for a breakthrough.
That's right.
Right. That's what Van used to say all the time. And so that there, I was inviting Saket to talk to us about that and how do we orient ourselves? Mm-hmm. And he said, you're right. We can't talk about it as an opportunity. That's crass. People are dying. I think there's real devastation and harm being caused.
That's right.
There is an opening. As this old thing falls away, as it falls apart, which is painful and so devastating, something else, it creates a space for something new to emerge, right? And so what I'm, what I feel like we're witnessing, and there's been so, and I've been, you know, I'm 47 years old now, and I've been doing social justice work since I was 17. And I did police accountability work for 10 years at the Ella Baker Center with Bay Area Police Watch, where I went and met families who the night before their loved one's life had been snatched by somebody in a blue uniform. And then I did youth organizing, around families of incarcerated youth. And same thing, when young people would die inside a facility, go and sit with a family. Right. And so I know that pain intimately. Right. And so I'm all, like, I often, when these episodes happen, when somebody is tragically, savagely killed by the law enforcement in the United States, I often don't watch the video. I'm a black man myself. I don't, you know what I mean? Psychically, I don't need the vicarious trauma. I try to distance myself in this, like, tremendous devastation of this man's life being taken. There isn't a death creates a portal. And it creates a portal for either further death and destruction or resurrection, renewal, and rebirth. And what young people have to, and so what I'm saddened for this young man's, I'm saddened for this man's daughter. I'm saddened for this man's community. I'm saddened for this man's other loved ones, right? His nieces and nephews. I'm saddened for that loss. Tremendous, and he never can be replaced, and that hurts me. And what I'm heartened by is that this is not a new story, but young people are responding to it in increasingly new ways. That they're saying that that devastation, that heartlessness, that hatred will not be the last word, right? Like it's trivial in some ways, but I've watched a video of this young woman who's a sex worker stop a line of police vehicles twerking in the street.
Wow.
They rolling up on the protest and she just stalks over there in her high 6-inch heels and puts on a show that stopped the whole line of police vehicles.
Get out of here. I haven't seen that.
Oh, on the internet, you look for sex workers, or a stripper, whatever they call. This, I'm saying, like,
wow.
20 years ago, she wouldn't have been able to, she would have had to stand in the back of the march and couldn't be at the march.
That's right. That's right.
Right?
She would not have been accepted at that march. That's right.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But now she is the front line of defense saying, you ain't coming for my people, and using culture that's throwaway that we don't want to talk about to do it.
And you know, when I think about, I love it, what you're talking about and what I'm seeing too with the Black movement for Black Lives being so led by women, by Black women, by young Black women who are a whole other kind of sensibility, acceptance. It's really a radical difference from the young Black and a lot of queer women versus the Black men who led other movements that we've had. And of course, times have changed in many, many ways. But it is so wonderful to see these Black women lead and how they lead. Like wrapping their hands, their arms around the entire Black nation, all the hues, all the genders, all the everything, how we come and how we show up. And I'm really
It is. That's the thing that gives me hope, is that there are these young people who are going to be free, even in the face of a police tank and a line of riot cops. They're going to not hide their light under a bushel, not pretend to be something, right? Not have to like fall into a box that is this acceptable of what it means to be Black, right? But they're going to say, no, they have an imagination and a view of what it is to be a Black person that is not a singularity or a binary or a one size fits all. It is like accepting and pushing forward. And that is, for me, profoundly inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Very inspiring.
And so, yeah, that's the thing that gives me like goosebumps and chills is watching these folks be able to do, and just be getting started. Right? People forget that it was the 50s, late 50s through the mid 60s.
Yeah.
Of what people call the civil rights movement and the Black freedom struggle. But it stretched back, if you look at Miss Ella Jo Baker and others, it stretched back to the 40s.
That's right.
Right? And so, like, if you imagine, you know, you asked who I've looked up to and who I've learned stuff from. Man, my sister Alicia Garza, when she was at Pueblo organizing in Oakland, right? Doing tenant organizing then. And my sister Latifah Simon, when she was in San Francisco organizing young women in the criminal justice system, we was giving each other game. You know, we claim each other. These are the people I learned so many games. Like, watching some of this, doing like, you said what? Did what? Damn, right? Can I try that? Let me see how that sounds when I say it. You know?
I love it.
So, yeah, these folks are just like, giving life.
You know, Jay, I can't help but think too, when I think about this double pandemic, right? The COVID-19 having, you know, the quote unquote lockdown and shelter in place and all, and then seeing our people dying in disproportionate numbers, way out of line with the numbers of people that are in every city and the deaths that taking place and feeling all of that, right? And also the thing about this COVID-19 time has been, you know, people, so funny, I was talking to my neighbor across the street, I mean, next door, that this time has allowed people to just slow down a little bit and stop a little bit. Like usually we're just running. With that calmed down, we're actually in our feelings more. And I'm finding that people are, right, more sensitive. They're in their feelings. They're actually...
Yes.
Looking at the fact that, you know, the sun is setting or whatever it might be, looking at life from a place, from an inward space. And so I think this COVID-19 has kind of, it was like the tenderizer that you put on the meat that softened everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then this happened with Mr. Floyd's murder and all the other murders around that. And I believe that the response that we're seeing is not coincidental. That it has happened right now with this COVID time happening. Because I honestly wonder, Jay, if this would have happened, you know, the murder of George Floyd, during a time when we were just doing our thing, would it have just been another Black man dead in the street, killed by?
Yeah, yeah.
And the young people who have been also, you know, they're busy doing their thing. They have slowed down and stopped as well. And so it feels to me like this double pandemic. It was perfect. It was like a perfect alignment of two pandemics coming together, the pandemic from the COVID and racism pandemic coming together that allowed this eruption, this incredible uprising to happen that I wonder honestly if it would have happened otherwise. And it has made it so felt. And then not just those who are out there in the street, but everybody who is watching, who's not out in the street, who's looking at it and going, damn, just grieving.
Yeah.
People are.
Yeah. Well, so I think there's a few things and I want to try to connect the dots. I think one is people are not on the treadmill. Like you said, they're not on the, or I might call it the rat mill for the rat race, right? That people have been forced to some degree out of it. So even those of us who are fortunate to work at home, there's a little bit more spaciousness.
That's right.
Even for those who like some of my siblings who, you know, they still got out there on the front line, there's still more spaciousness.
Right.
Right. In our lives. And the folks who got those unemployment checks and that sort of like that fake universal basic income for the last few weeks where they didn't have to be on the grind. We actually saw that folks had more bandwidth to pay attention. I'm not just thinking about my daily needs.
That's right.
Where my next meal gonna come from? Where this check? Can you take some extra shifts this weekend so I can pay for it? Da, 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 da. And I know I got this thing, but they just had a little bit of more spaciousness to be able to say, well, wait a minute.
That's right.
Yeah?
That's right.
Wait a minute. What the hell going on, right? To be able to pay attention to it. I think the other thing that happened with COVID that I think you're absolutely right is here we are fighting for our lives. Mm-hmm. Literally. Everybody around us.
Everybody.
We're fighting for our lives.
Well, we're a little more than others.
Yeah. Supposedly, right? And they're going to go pull this man out of car. Kneel on his neck.
And kill him.
For 9 minutes.
9 minutes.
Right? Like.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it was like, wait a minute.
You said it. We are right now, just the general feeling and energy is saving each other's lives. Saving each other's lives, honoring all the medical workers, honoring everybody who's doing all the things, the essential workers, honoring finally, people who are on the lines, and we are looking at honoring those who are saving lives. We're in a moment on the planet really looking at saving our lives. And then this happens.
Right. Because they're not thinking about none of that. And they're just like, this year, and I'm going to say it, this year Negro is out of line.
Yep.
We're going to put him back in line.
That's right. Just another.
Right?
That's right.
And we're going to show him. Yes. And that is what America saw. They saw that. Police race. They do not police crime.
Right.
Right? Because the boy who went in there and shot up Mother Emanuel Church got a hamburger.
Hello.
This man who was accused of passing a false $20 got a death sentence.
That's right. That's right.
Right? So we're policing race.
Yeah, we're policing.
Like, I can't imagine the context that you take a mass murderer for lunch. I don't, I'm not saying starve the boy. That's not what I'm saying. But I can't imagine you just don't say, hey, you can wait until, did you have lunch before you went and murdered all these black people, or should we stop and get you some? I don't understand the conversation around that.
Right. That's right. And there lies the difference. And we know it. We've been knowing it. We've been knowing it for a long time. And, you can't get away now from all of the cell phones and videos and social media and all of that also converging at this time. You know, it's another moment. It's another moment in America. And I am, watching as you are, as everybody is, and with a glimmer of hope that, who thought that defund the police from Black Lives Matter would end up with, it's like, what? Did I just hear that correctly?
So this is what I mean about, the radical imagination. And this is why that
something is shifting. My friend who lives in Minneapolis was telling me that after the elected officials decided, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to, reorganize this. We don't know what it's going to look like, but you know what it's going to look like. She lives there, the woman that I work with every day. And she said that, so right after that, there was just, this massive, folks in the street, thousands of people. And the city council folks got up and said, okay, gave them a prompt about, like, we don't know, but you know. Get into clusters. It was like, and they got into little groups, right? And gave them a prompt. What do you think about? And text it to us and gave them a. And she said the entire place was people coming together in little, quads and groups. And like if you're in some kind of a conference, right? And really came together in groups and talked and texted to the number what they came up with. They are literally taking it from the people. I am so hopeful with that. What an example that sets. What an example. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We know this is not working. This hasn't been working in a long time. And we're finally saying, done. And y'all know what to do. Let's harvested from the people.
What gives me hope about that? What gives me hope about that is the lie that capitalism and patriarchy, and not even capitalism, but the thing up under it, that you can own parts of the world, that you can, and that the quest for ownership and profit, that those things supersede, that the lie that creates is that there has to be one way. And so when people say like, well, there's 1,500 police departments, and so what are you going to do if you don't have the police? Well, then that means there's 1,500 opportunities to figure it out that works for there, that you can actually make it. Like, the environment doesn't work. Like, the ecosystem, the way that the desert uses water is not the same way that the rainforest or the ocean uses water. So why does my community have to use the same policing tactics or the same economic system or the same, just, well, that is to make it easy for the free flow of capital and accumulation and people who have wealth to transcend and go back. But like, I don't have, if brown rice go good over there and mangoes grow good over here, why I gotta grow brown rice over here? Just, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, why can't I grow my mangoes? Like, what, you know what I'm saying? And so I think this thing in that is like, that is real democracy.
Mm-hmm.
When people really have a choice about their lives. And that is like, again, Black, queer, women, trans folks who are saying, I've never fit in these boxes. And so I'm not trying to fit in none of these. I'm not trying to have us have no more boxes. We're going to have to come up with some new shapes.
That's right, a new shape.
You know what I'm saying? We don't need some new shapes. And that is like,
yeah,
when I don't have to like figure out what that, how to fit in that new box, but I get to be like, how am I be? That's really free. And there's no one way to be free. That's the other thing about it.
There's no one way
to be free.
That's right.
And so then we could just not know together and go make it up together. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is like, that's actually life. Mm-hmm. So this is the I know we're getting close to the time, but when I, on my magic journey to this place, I ended up working at a youth group that was based on popular education work coming out of Brazil. And I got introduced to one of my mentors, OG, Alicia Miranda, and Michael James, who Michael James had met Paulo Freire when he was in undergrad and like hosted Paulo Freire, I think at SF State, and got to hang out with Paulo Freire and take him around.
Wow.
And so I got to learn from him about popular process and about like what they were trying to do in Brazil during that time. And what they talked about was, and what Freire talked about was that what it means to be fully autonomous person is to be designing the, co-designing the world you live in.
Mm.
To not just be inheriting somebody else's framework that you have to shoehorn and fit yourself into, cut off an arm because it don't get in, right? Shave off your, you see? But to say, no, we're going to co-design this world together. And that's what it really means to be a full human being.
Yes, right there. Right? That's it.
Yeah. So this is what gives me hope, is that these young people are doing that.
Yep.
And doing it from such a spiritual, connected, open,
yep,
not needing to have all the answers, but needing to just keep saying what's true, which is this ain't working.
And the multicultural look of it as well is just really so hopeful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm loving this moment, and I'm praying in this moment that, you know, folks be safe out there. You know, given all the things from COVID to, you know, to the destruction of Black bodies that keep happening, Black and brown bodies.
Yeah.
And I am just so praying for all of it, but really hopeful that real transformation is on the horizon and is happening. I can't help but feel that. And because this is an extraordinary time. It's extraordinary. COVID alone was extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
It's on top of it. It's like this perfect storm. and may the storm just be the storm that then when the, you know, the rain and the storm and the clouds and everything go crazy and the lightning and all that. And then it breaks open to this beautiful day. Hello, this beautiful day. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah.
And we are in the storm.
I'm hopeful for that. I'm hopeful for that. And I'm trying to stay present to all of it.
Yeah.
All the pain, all the loss. And for those, even in me and my friends who are in, and even myself sometimes, who are disquieted by it, right? That like, we know we need something different and we're still disquieted by the, there is, my partner's a midwife. And midwives start off working, birthing, helping birthing people bring their children into the world. And many of them later in life go into hospice care, which is a very interesting,
interesting.
Opposite sides of the door. Yeah. And what I am attuned to is that in that birthing, mm-hmm. the old does perish,
mm-hmm.
right? And as much as a Black person, as a person who grew up working quite poor, I just say working poor in this country, there's a lot of ways that I like stuff. Like to be able to go to the store and just get what I want when my check comes, right? And for the last few months, I've not been able to do that. That's been a quote-unquote loss of some normalcy. And for people who grew up in a world where they understood how white privilege functioned or male privilege functioned or wealth privilege functioned, and so they knew it, they might not have always liked it, but knew it and knew how to accommodate themselves and knew how to perform in it. Right. Now being in this world we were remaking where the old rules are not yet, I mean, the old rules don't work and the new rules ain't yet clear, yeah. that could be unsettling. And so I want to hold both the excitement and the like, yes, and the come on with it of what's new yeah. and make some space for the folks who are, and even in myself, that feeling of the loss and the mourning
yeah.
Of hospicing the old.
Absolutely. Yeah? Absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't leave, the old does not leave without the tears and without the sadness.
Yeah.
There's something that, yeah, I get that. It's holding all of it, right? That kind of having that kind of equanimity that can just hold it all, you know?
Yeah. And I'm not always good at that because I flame on people on the internet too when they start talking stuff about my sisters who are leading BLM and how they're not making enough space for men and blah, 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 and all that fragile male ego stuff that comes up, right? That, and I'm like, but then I got to realize like, oh, you don't know yet how to act. You were told you had this privilege.
That's right. You had male privilege and you don't know how to be right now. And that's
without it.
That also is you know, on the chopping block. Patriarchy is very much on the chopping block, along with racism, all of it is. And so it's like, you know, come on now, where's my place as a Black man?
Hey, so this is what I love again about Black Lives Matter and the simplicity of it, is it's like, no, Black Lives Matter. And so that means that women and queer and trans lives have to matter. And so then you can't just be like, well, you know, Black Lives Matter, but get behind me, woman.
Oh, those days are so over, thank God.
Oh, and they're dying hard.
They don't even know nothing about that. They're like, oh no. Mm-hmm. And brothers, and so you know, mm-hmm. so how do we raise Black men now? How do we raise Black men, Black young boys to understand life differently, right? So, you know, to be able to deal with the fact that, you know, you may be under somebody's knee on the ground and how, where the respect is for all of us in understanding Black women and where we've been and where we are now. And that this gender thing is very different. It cannot be replicated. The gender thing cannot be replicated.
No, but there has to be a new paradigm. And we don't know what that is. And people want there to be this paradigm where it's like, you know, people talk about the Black family. And I'm like, okay, yeah, all Black families. Black families that have two mamas and two daddies right. and two people who don't, and one of them, or and one mama and one person who don't identify as they, them. as identifies as parent. That's a Black family too. And they're going to be free too. Right.
That's right.
And we have to have those struggles, and I am for it. And I want to make, you know, trying to figure out how do I hold the line and make space for my brothers to grieve as we struggle with like, oh, that, you know, all that stuff that I've been told, that ain't right. Ain't going to work no more out here.
So then I have to ask you one last question. And that is your role as a mentor, your role, everything that you were saying, Jay, your role as a mentor, I'm wondering what's up in terms of young Black men, other Black men being able to translate, because you honestly, if anybody can hold court and hold church around it, it's you.
I mean, and I do my best, but you know, it's interesting. I think there's some things I can say, you know, Phil could talk to me because I knew who Phil was. So Phil pulled me aside and say, yo, let me tell you something about what you just said, right? Brother Greg Hodge, another person, could call me up. Brother Greg, call me up and say, Jay, I saw you in that meeting, heard what you said, bro, don't be out there like that. Because I know Greg. So some of these young people, you know, I have relationships with them like that where I can say something to them and they can hear me, right? But some of these folks, you know, one of my OG homies who was a youth organizer said, young people don't care what you know until they know that you care.
Until they know.
Right? Yeah. And so, yeah. So, you know, I have my people who I work with, and I work through them, and I, you know, my day job is I'm a coach, right? Working with organizations and senior leaders,
right,
at the management center. And I do it through that. And then I have people who I speak to, but like, you know, our new ED at One Life Institute, Zan West, sis is on fire and doing incredible work, and I'm supporting her. And, you know, at Greenpeace, I'm putting my hands on folks, I'm talking to folks, and I'm trying to interject here and there where I can. And, so that's the way I'm doing it. And I'm so open, and I still have my young ones who I rap with, and I get out on the internet and we chop it up here and there. And I tell them when I see, you know, certain things. Good. And I'm trying to lead by example, you know? Yeah. And then folks who are my age and older, I knuckle up on them though. I ain't gonna even lie. On the internet, be flaming on them. Like, bro, you said what? Nah, man. You know what I mean? Like, And then I have to like try to, okay. That's not helpful. Let me think about how I can reformulate this. And my partner be like, man, don't be arguing on the internet. And I'm like, we at home. Where, how come I can't argue when I'm in person?
Don't turn them right.
You know what I mean? And the only way I can talk to is on the internet. All I can do is talk with my thumbs right now, you know?
Right now. Well, I'm going to tell you something. You have been a role model for me since I first heard your name, since we met. And I am just, you know, there's a reason why, you know, you were on the top of my list to start this podcast. It was like, okay, who do I need? I need my peeps who I admire and adore, who are heartfelt and just beautiful beings, smart, and in the world in the way that I want to always be in the world. And that's you, okay? You represent all of that for me. And I'm so grateful with that.
Thank you.
That you're my friend, my comrade, and honestly, my mentor. And so
That means a great deal coming from you, Conda. I appreciate you and all your work, everything you've done. I'm on Team Conda from day one to the end.
Yeah. Well, I'm really grateful for that and for you. And you know, I usually like to end with a little bit of ceremony. I don't know if you got a little prayer to pray us out or.
Always. Please join me in the spirit of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
God of my ancestors, spirit of many names, I come to you giving thanks and praises for Sister Conda and all of her work. I give thanks for everything set in motion, everything said today and unsaid, all the healing and justice unfolding around right now. Divine One, I ask that you be with each of us, everyone in hearing of my voice, in our trials and tribulations. I'll ask that you clear our paths, offer us your strength, your wisdom, connect with us, and allow us to see you unfolding all around us in the eyes and hands and words of those around us. Allow us to do just in our relationships and right in your world. For the young ones on their way, we ask that you light their path as you have lit ours. And we give thanks for those who came before us and paved the way. And we ask that you make clear all that we need to do, our little part that we can while it's ours, that you strengthen our backs, steel our arms, and open our hearts, our ears, and our eyes to see your beauty and justice being done. In your many holy names, we pray. Amen. Ashe.
Ashe.
So it is.
Ashe. Ashe. Thank you, my brother. This has been a beautiful time.
Thank you, Kanda.
All right. You take good care of yourself.
Always a pleasure.
Always.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
Good thanks.
And this is the end of the Brown Rice Hour with Kanda Mason. Thank you for joining. Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.